You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There have been many reports about increasing automation, growing inequality, and declining job satisfaction among American workers. What's happened to the stable and prosperous workplaces of the 1950s and 60s? Rick Wortsman, director of the Drucker Institute's K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society, examines the history of the changing social contract between employer and employees in his latest book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rick Wortsman to our show today. Hello.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Now, whose loyalty has ended? Workers' loyalty or employers', or employers' loyalty to employees?
Well, I think it has been disproportionately over the arc of my book, over this 75-year arc from the end of World War II until today, first employers shedding loyalty to their employees. And now we're in a situation where, particularly for millennials and, you know, sort of stereotypically so, they're willing and often eager to bounce around from job to job. So it cuts both directions, but primarily that title refers to the end of loyalty from employer to employee.
How do companies reward loyal employees nowadays?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, in the best cases, look, many people still have good jobs, despite the subtitle of my book, the Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. You have a good job, right? You love your job. I'm fortunate. I love my job. I think what we've seen is this split, and it reflects one of the things you mentioned, this growing inequality in society. We have shifted from an economy that was driven in many ways by blue-collar labor, and most significantly, if you were a blue-collar laborer in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even, you know, into the 70s, you could have few skills, little education, and find a path to the middle class. And you worked hard and you were rewarded from your employer. They were loyal to you. You were loyal to them. And their loyalty took the form of high pay, good benefits, and so on. Today, there are no longer those paths to the middle class for the unskilled, uneducated.
James Comey says that Donald Trump said he expected loyalty from him. Was that because Trump came out of business?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about, you know, Donald Trump's to try and get in his head anyway, where he could have been coming from. Maybe there was a business, you know, sort of a sentiment to that, particularly for a closely held family-run business. That probably is a place where you find more loyalty than some of the bigger corporations. So, yeah, that may have been part of what he was talking about.
We'll get into more detail in a bit. But in general, what form did loyalty take in the past?
So, again, the form that it really took was expecting, you know, workers to show up and work hard and give an honest effort and so forth. And in return, they got steadily rising wages through, again, this period from the end of World War II to the early 70s. They got good benefits and rising benefits. So these were guaranteed pensions. And they got good health care benefits. All of those improved over that period.
So the real change occurs in the 70s, which is what we'll get to in a little bit.
Yes.
You quote Peter Drucker, the Austrian-born management consultant, who wrote, "A healthy business cannot exist in a sick society."
Yes.
Is it our society or our businesses or both that are sick?
I think it's both. So one of the things that I write a lot about in the book is the way that companies have shifted from an orientation where executives explicitly wanted to take care of all of their stakeholders. Their shareholders, yes, their customers, the communities where they had their operations, and their workers. And they talked about balancing the interests of all of those. There was a profound shift that began in the mid-70s and then really accelerated through the 80s and 90s and into today, where the ethic has become all around maximizing shareholder value. And all these other stakeholders have been very explicitly left behind, including employees. And I think that that is a cultural shift that reflects what's happened in society, and those corporate norms have changed as in part as a result reflecting these bigger societal shifts.
You suggest in the book that executives now think more about I and
That's
less
right.
about we.
Yes.
So it's I and the shareholders and the workers are just the people who get the things done?
Well, I think what's happened is, so again, a bigger cultural shift in American society reflected in these corporate norms. So coming out of, remember where we came out of, the Depression and World War II, there was more of a we culture at that point. We were all in this together. That has shifted to more of an I culture where the marketplace is sacrosanct. And now executives' compensation, CEO compensation, has been very explicitly tied to that of shareholders. So they are part of the I.
You talk about a social contract between employers and employees. What do you mean by that?
Well, I define the social contract as all the things we've been talking about: job security, pay, health benefits, pension benefits, and to some degree worker engagement. And it really was. It was an explicit way that we were going to and companies wanted the economy and society to function.
Rousseau described a social contract between government and citizens. Did business leaders see themselves as governing employees?
I think they did. I don't know if I'd quite use the word governing, but they certainly, at the end of World War II, there was a very, very explicit idea among corporate leaders that they were going to provide for their employees. And government certainly had a role, and it needed to provide a safety net, but that was really a floor, and that they would take responsibility for providing the key pay and benefits and so on for the American workforce.
Didn't some business leaders take a paternalistic attitude to their workers? Was that necessarily a good thing?
It's a real mix of impulses that was going on. So certainly was there some paternalism going on? Absolutely. But again, I think there was also at the same time this ethic that we're all in this together. We came through World War II and the Depression together. And there was much less distance between top executives and those on the shop floor than there is today.
And you begin your book in 1943 during World War II. What was happening then? Were corporate attitudes toward workers changing?
Well, there was a lot of concern among corporate leaders. I opened my book with in the wake of the founding of an organization called the Committee for Economic Development. The CED is still around today. It's now part of the conference board. And this was an organization started by major American companies. And their first effort was to ensure that enough good jobs would be created for servicemen returning home so that we didn't wind up in another Great Depression.
Which was just a recent memory.
A very recent memory and a very real fear that this other depression might be worse than the one that happened in the 30s unless they could create good, stable jobs.
So that was a joint – that involved joint planning between government and business?
It involved – no, actually. I mean, there was some government sort of involvement, and government had its own planning efforts going on. But this was – the CED's effort was really an effort by business, by major corporations – to work with local businesses all across the country at the local level to help them convert their wartime technology to good consumer products, to help them regulate inventories and so on. Again, all with an eye on providing good and stable jobs for those coming home.
My guest is Rick Wortsman. His book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. In the 1920s and 30s, the economists and others debated what they called welfare capitalism. What was that?
So welfare capitalism, I mean, it sort of has some different definitions depending on, you know, which scholar is using the term. Sort of classically, this was an effort by a certain group of companies to provide great benefits and good pay to their workers, a lot of perks, partly in an effort to thwart labor organizers. In other words, if we're taking great care of you, we don't need these outsiders to come in and try and win you higher wages and better conditions and health care and so on.
And you look at four companies, General Motors, General Electric, Kodak, and Coca-Cola. Why those four?
So they were four companies that were instrumental in the founding of the Committee for Economic Development. So this is narrative history. I love scenes and characters, and that drives my book. And all four of these companies, I begin with their leaders sort of setting out this vision for post-war America economically and socially, and then weave in and out of them over the next 70 years.
And they were already kind of old by 1943.
Yes.
The youngest of the four, GM, was founded in 1908.
Yep.
Coca-Cola in 1886.
Yes, yes. So, yes, these were already the giants of the day, and they are I guess less so in the case of Kodak for sure, and even GM. They're less giant than they were, but these are iconic American companies.
How were they preparing in 1943 for a post-war economy?
Well, they were now, in some cases, particularly GM and GE and even Kodak to some extent, they were converting from a wartime footing, again, to a peacetime economy and needing to convert plants that had been making weaponry back to a civilian economy that was on the poised of booming. Remember, we were about to enter this age where the great American middle class would be created and rise.
Did these four companies differ much in their approaches to their relations with their employees?
They did. They really did. So General Motors and to a great degree, particularly in that era, General Electric were their relations were defined to a great degree by their relationships with unions, the United Auto Workers or the electrical workers in the case of GE. Kodak, which, again, practiced welfare capitalism, they always managed to keep organized labor at bay by providing such great pay and perks.
Hadn't there been a surge in labor unrest during the Great Depression? Were government or business or labor leaders concerned about possible unrest after the war?
They were, and rightly so. It turned out there was a great strike wave that happened around 1945-46. A tremendous amount of time lost from workers hitting the picket lines. This became a huge political issue and helped the Republicans sweep into Congress at that point, including Richard Nixon as a congressman who really made it an issue in his campaign.
It also was a problem for unions in some cases. Wildcat strikes went against the leadership.
That's right. So, right, you had union members just going out on their own, defying, in some cases, their leadership that was looking for more stability.
Weren't programs under welfare capitalism intended to blunt the force of labor movements and head off government intervention?
Absolutely. As I said, yeah, that was very much, and Kodak is, in my book, kind of the leading model of using that tactic. And it worked. Kodak was never organized despite some attempts by unions.
The federal government had passed legislation like the National Labor Relations Act during the Depression. Were more laws passed during the war and after?
So after the war, most significantly, and in part in reaction to this great strike wave of the mid-1940s, the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947.
And which was seen as an anti-labor act.
Seen very much as an anti-labor act that tipped the balance in some ways back toward kind of the corporate side of things and being able to fend off organized labor and organized labor's tactics.
Was that to some degree in response to what was going on in Europe where we were seeing, socialist movements surging and also National Health Service in England and similar situations all throughout Europe?
There was certainly
what Eisenhower called creeping socialism.
There was certainly always a fear among business leaders of creeping socialism. It was one of the impulses, actually, very early on when the Committee for Economic Development was founded, why they wanted to provide good jobs, good benefits, and so on. They worried that if they didn't, and America did return to another depression, that socialism or even communism might take root on American soil.
My guest is Rick Wortsman, the director of the K.H. Moon Center for a Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute, which is a part of Claremont Graduate University. His latest book is The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It's published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're back with Rick Wortsman. His latest book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America, published by Public Affairs. As we were saying, in Europe, there were health programs that were set up that we in this country might have considered socialist. So what was our approach?
So our approach was that we would tie somebody's health insurance largely to their employer, and they would have access to insurance through their employer. And again, these benefits rose tremendously through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And at that point, about 70% or more of the American workforce had some form of health coverage through their employer.
And then companies also established pensions for their workers.
They did. The earliest ones, actually, I think American Express had the earliest pension in something like 1875. But again, pensions really took off in the 1950s and 60s and grew. And the key difference, these are guaranteed pensions. So you are guaranteed a benefit for the rest of your days after you retired from the company, a set amount of money, very different from the 401ks and so-called defined contribution plans we have today.
When did the 401ks come in?
So the law actually came in the Revenue Act of 1978. Part of the tax code. There was a change made, and nobody thought it was a big deal at the time. It was kind of a provision slipped in for a very different purpose. And some folks in the financial products industry realized that there was a product to be had, and this shift began from, again, defined benefit plans to these much less secure defined contribution plans.
Did business leaders accept minimum wages, pensions, health care, unions, and so on because they thought it was right or because they had no choice at the time?
I think it was a mix of things. Again, politically, we were in a very different place. We were in a place where the idea of limited government was not as prominent as it is today. It wasn't kind of the leading force. And so it was just a different culture, a different time.
Partly because people saw the New Deal as having saved the American economy?
I think that's...
Controversial when it was enacted, but by the 40s, the economy was booming.
Yes. That is true. I think there was definitely some of that going on. In terms of unions, I think some corporate leaders came to appreciate, particularly through this so-called period of industrial peace in the 1950s through the mid-50s into the late 50s, that unions provided a measure of stability and that at least there were contracts that you could count on, and it helped you actually regulate and plan for your own business.
Economists talk of externalities, costs of or benefits that affect those not involved in the actual choice. Were there externalities, positive or negative, with the social contract between workers and businesses?
Well, there were. I mean, one big externality that, again, comes through, and I focused a lot on unions at the beginning of the book because they were so important in the establishment of the social contract for the workforce as a whole. So even if you didn't carry a union card, you weren't a union member, you, through this period, greatly benefited by what unions were doing for their members. There was what scholars call a spillover effect, a tremendous spillover effect for other blue-collar workers and white-collar workers as well.
Now, we're talking about companies. What about politicians? Were they going along with all of this?
I mean, they were. Again, the rules of the road were being set and reset through things like the Taft-Hartley Act, adjusting, pulling a little more to the right ideologically, if you will, from where the National Labor Relations Act had been. So, look, government's role is to set a safety net and to provide the kind of guardrails for where business operates in between. But my book focuses on business because this is where most people get their income, get their benefits from. And so, you know, one of the premises of my book is that while there's so much focus on government, most people live their lives through, you know, welfare capitalism, not the welfare state.
But a lot of people do work for government.
Yes.
And government sure. attitudes toward their workers have changed along with business attitudes toward workers.
They have, although I think significantly the public sector is still the one place where you find a significant percentage of the workforce unionized versus the private sector, where we're down to under 7% of the private sector workforce belonging to a union.
Had the experience of the Depression influenced the attitudes or of the executives at the four companies you were looking at? Had any of them experienced hardship?
Well, the one that comes to mind, I guess, even a little bit earlier is Gerard Swope of General Electric, who came out of MIT and I think through the 20s, maybe the teens and 20s, had worked at Hull House, the immigrant settlement house in Chicago, where he really developed a great kind of affinity for the working class and appreciated their struggles and took that with him into the top job at General Electric when he rose through the ranks there.
For decades, IBM only picked CEOs who had been at the company for at least 25 years.
Yes.
decades ago, wasn't that kind of company experience far more common than it is today?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that that did, it gave companies what some call domain knowledge. They knew a lot about the business that the company was in. You know, if you were at U.S. Steel, you knew something about metallurgy and what it took to forge steel. Now, the kind of the shift is that a lot of people graduate with an MBA and sort of presume they can manage anything.
So they are managers by training now.
That's right.
Are companies like Google or Facebook different because the original founders still exert a lot of control?
I mean, they're different in a lot of ways. I talk about Silicon Valley a bit at the end of my book. You know, in some ways, these are throwbacks in that they give great benefits to their employees. It's a little bit of modern day welfare capitalism. You know, it's just you get sushi free for lunch and you have a ping pong table or a foosball table. But it is a form of welfare capitalism. The issue there is that those companies, they don't create very many jobs by and large, not like the big industrial behemoths of the past. And secondly, those jobs, and they're great jobs, are only for knowledge workers. They're for people of high amounts of education. They are not a path to the middle class for those with limited skills in education.
And as we see with Apple and many of these other companies, they outsource most of their manufacturing these days.
That's right.
After Tim Cook took over Apple, we heard a lot about the company stashing money overseas to avoid taxes.
Mm. Yep. They're not the only company that has had various tax avoidance schemes. But again, for the working class, and you see all the angst and anger expressed in the election, folks who do feel like they've been left behind, what my book documents is you have the corporate safety net, if you will, that's been torn to shreds. And at the same time, you have companies that are doing everything they can not to pay into the to create a bigger public safety net. So that's a pretty tough situation.
And yet they complain that corporate taxes are higher in this country than anywhere else in the world.
Yes, although that is really not true if you look at the effective tax rate once all the loopholes are taken into consideration.
Is Apple also part of what some call financialization, increasing reliance on financial means for profit and increasing influence of the financial industry?
Well, I'm not sure about Apple, and I think Apple's a great company in many, many ways. I've got an Apple phone in my pocket and an Apple computer in my bag. So
that's probably because you don't work for Foxconn. You think that they're okay?
Yeah, well, that is true. And look, there's a lot of issues with obviously labor being moved overseas, and that we can get into that. A lot of ways to think about it, but the financialization of the economy is a huge issue. And again, a lot of it goes back to this idea of trying to maximize shareholder value above all else.
My guest is Rick Wortsman. His latest book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Do business leaders nowadays think that workers no longer have a realistic chance to resist in the way that workers did when the U.S. economy was growing so rapidly?
Well, workers don't have as much of a chance to resist in many cases. Again, particularly those who are low skill with little education. Remember, we're in a country where more than half the adult population does not have any kind of post-secondary degree, not a 4-year college diploma, not a 2-year community college degree, not even any kind of post-secondary technical credential.
But hasn't that been changing?
Well, there has been over time more and more of the American workforce, more and more of the adult population has gotten educated, but we're still leaving half the population behind. You're in an economy where, again, those folks, they have no recourse to push back. Those are your temp workers, your part-time workers, or they've just dropped out of the labor force altogether because they can't find good employment.
So what led to the change of relations between employers and employees? When did it shift?
Well, the shift, it's interesting. You can start to see the fabric tearing in the late 50s, which is one of the surprises in my research.
Because the economy was still booming at the time.
It was booming, and the benefits were still growing, and the pay was growing. But these trends were starting, these undercurrents were starting, and they are automation and technology and its impact, globalization and trade and its impact, the decline of unions, this shift to knowledge work. And as I say, there was a beginning that even then of the financialization of corporate America, and then later would come this push to maximize shareholder value and shareholder primacy, which really amplified all of these other trends, the impact of all of these other trends.
And why did that focus on shareholder value emerge?
Well, it's really just a matter of math. I mean, you have a kind of a pie, if you will. Let's say that represents corporate profits. And the question is, how are you going to divide up that pie? And corporate profits have been near records in recent years. Workers have not shared in those gains. Shareholders have disproportionately shared those gains.
You say that GM was instrumental in building up the social contract and then pivotal in pulling it down. What happened?
Well, pivotal in pulling it down, particularly in regards to healthcare benefits. So I detail a case of how they had pulled back on some promises made to their retirees in particular and providing them with fully paid lifetime health benefits.
I was wondering, don't happier workers make a company more productive? Why start seeing your workers as the opposition?
Well, it's a great question. There is a lot of research that suggests absolutely what you're saying is true. And there's a lot of lip service given to this, right? You ask almost any executive, what's your most important asset? And they will always say, oh, it's our people. But then, again, few act like it, particularly when it comes to those on the front lines. It may be true in the executive suite. It may be true even through the ranks of management and middle management in many cases. And jobs have improved in some ways in those areas, but at the front lines, not so much.
What about government policy in the late 1970s? Didn't Paul Volcker and the Fed shift their focus to keeping inflation low rather than worrying about unemployment?
They did. I mean, at that time, inflation was just a huge issue. We had runaway inflation, and at the same time, we had hugely high unemployment, right? This idea of stagflation. You had both of these phenomena at once, and so inflation needed to be tamed, and there was some tough medicine that Volcker had to prescribe.
Wasn't there another factor, race, in the story? Wasn't the workforce far more homogeneous in the 40s and 50s, mostly white males? How did more women and minorities in the labor pool affect the views of business leaders?
Yeah, well, thank you, Leonard, for bringing that up, because it's really an important point. So I don't want to over-romanticize what this golden age of business, as I call it, through the 50s and 60s was like. It was golden if you were a white man. And then I do document when people of color and women started to come into the workforce in far greater numbers and the tremendous discrimination they faced.
And then many industries started moving south around the same time that
Yes.
Southerners started voting Republican more, and people in the North tended to vote for the Democratic Party.
Well, they started moving south really because labor was cheaper, and labor was cheaper in part because these were often right-to-work states, which makes it hard for unions to organize, and so wages are often lower, and they were very explicitly GE and GM in particular moving plants out of the Northeast and into the South.
And in some cases, fairly recently, we had a situation where a company was encouraging its workers to unionize, but they voted against the union.
Mm. Yeah, unions have gotten a black eye, a bad name, you know, in some cases because of their own missteps and some cases because of their own reach. And they kind of maybe lost some of their own purpose and sense of purpose. But I do think that it has been, by and large, employers going after unions that have really caused their decline.
We've also been talking recently about a new gig economy. More Americans working on a contingent basis. How can there be a social contract when you don't know where you'll be working the next month?
Well, we need to have a new social contract that recognizes that this is the fastest growing part of the workforce, depending on estimates, anywhere from 15 to even more than 30%, depending on how you count it, of workers are now independent so-called gig workers. And what we need to do is create portable benefits for these workers that they can take from assignment to assignment, job to job.
So what might be done to improve the relations between employers and employees?
Well, I think what has to happen in a lot of ways is this cultural shift. I don't think we're going to go back to the kind of golden age we had in terms of the social contract between employer and employee of the 50s and 60s. Too many changes. The economy is way different now. Too many pressures. But there are also choices that business leaders can make, and they can split that pie differently. They can invest more in their workers, for sure.
You're right. We need to recognize that the social contract between employer and employee won't be strong unless our business leaders want it to be so.
That is right. And to me, that's being a good, responsible leader. If you're going to say our people are our most important asset, then act like it.
But we see a wide gap. Silicon Valley firms are offering perks to their employees, massages, gyms, transportation. Some offer unlimited vacation days. And on the other hand, Walmart and McDonald's, who are among the largest private employers now, really try to lowball their workers.
In many cases, they do. And Walmart's an interesting case, and I talk a lot about Walmart, particularly closer to the years, 2000 to the 2000 sort of five or so. They have been trying to invest more in their workers, in part from what you said. They realize that if they do pay more, their workers will provide better service. They'll be happier and provide better service to their customers. They're investing. I think they need to go way further, but they're starting to get it.
Is welfare capitalism still thriving for Wall Street and other major corporations through bailouts, intellectual property protections, et cetera?
Well, that's welfare capitalism of a different sort. That's where the companies are getting the welfare as opposed to the workers getting the welfare from their employer.
And then there have been recent reports of companies imposing non-compete clauses that, in effect, bind employees to their current employer. Are remaining elements of the capital labor social contract deteriorating even more?
That's a great thing. It's a big issue in Silicon Valley in particular, those kinds of clauses that you're talking about. Yeah, I mean, we're in an era where the social contract does continue to discriminate in many ways because these big forces are not going away. They're accelerating. Automation, globalization, unions are not coming back, this shift to knowledge work. So then it's a matter of choice for business leaders. What do they want to do? Do they say, this is a time we need to provide even more benefits, more training, more support for our most vulnerable workers, our most vulnerable neighbors? Or is this a time we want to continue to maximize shareholder value above all else? That's a choice.
Do they need to learn more about their workers?
It's a good question. Again, I think there is a distance that has opened up from the executive suite to those on the front line that just wasn't there socially so much in the 50s, 40s and 50s.
Rick Wartzman is the director of the K.H. Moon Center for Functioning Society at the Drucker Institute, which is a part of Claremont Graduate University. He's the author of a number of books. The one we've been discussing, his latest, is The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It is published by Public Affairs. Rick, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It was great.